I'm not going to give all of this talk, but this is a talk I gave the day of the announcement. So I am in Planck, but in a relatively minor role. I'm not part of the core team. So a lot of what I say is viewed from outside the main people who've been working on the project. But I'll skip the intro, but get to the things that were happening on that day. So Planck satellite's been going for a while. A few things that are worth noting. The Planck release that you've seen on March 21st is from the so-called nominal mission. That's how long the mission was supposed to be at the point of launch, which was two full sky surveys. In fact, the satellite lasted about twice as long as that, so there are a further two full sky surveys in the can, and for the LFI instrument, more than that. And in about a year's time, there'll be a second data release, which will therefore have about twice as much statistical power. Hopefully, we'll also have enhanced analysis as well. Another thing worth bearing in mind is that the current release only releases the temperature data, at least as far as the primary CMB is concerned. There's no polarization data. People may be aware that polarization carries a lot of very useful information, but it proved to be too difficult to analyze that on the time scale that was available. And so that's reserved to the next time. So there's a pile of stuff that's made public, which, judging by your expertise, none of you are remotely interested in until we get down to about here, I think, and particularly parameters in this list, but the fundamental properties you can download are all of these things, and 28 papers were released on March the 21st, which go under the banner of Planck 2013 results. We're getting all of these together right at the last minute, pretty much, and one of them seems to have failed to make the cut and didn't appear that morning, rather ominously entitled Consistency of the Data.
That one, you just get the list of all of them.
Oh, do you? Oh, they're all consistent with each other.
Do you have any insight into what happened? Is that why?
I do not know it. I was as surprised as anyone else when that one didn't appear, I'm afraid. So the ones I actually worked on were number 20 and number 29. The only ones I worked directly on, and then I was a kind of a reviewer for some of the cosmology papers on non-Gaussianity and other things, just internal reviewer. So anyway.
So do you know when this consistency paper will come out?
Imminently, I assume. It's a class one paper that was supposed to be mandatory for release that day.
I hear that the part of the goal of that paper was to see consistency between WM data and Planck data. And there's some curious inconsistency that we're trying to figure out. So
okay, right, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know the answer to that. So anyway, this is what Planck does. It makes sky maps at different microwave frequencies. The WMAP had five frequencies that ran more or less from here up to about this level. Is it 94. Is highest frequency. These are pretty much all what are called low frequencies for Planck, which extends up to much higher frequencies into what we call the submillimeter. And what you hopefully see is different features becoming dominant in the maps. The galaxy here is seen in synchrotron. And by the time you get up to here, dust in our galaxy is very, very dominant. And these high frequency channels are mostly there to help subtract out the dust from the ones in the middle, which are the ones that are most sensitive to the cosmic microwave background.
CMB has been subtracted from all of this,
right? Oh, yes, so these are, yes, that's right.
Can I ask a stupid question? Is medium gloves, I think, third, fourth, and fifth, there is some spherical shapes. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah, these will be scanning strategy artifacts to the elliptic poles here. Akira will know much more than me about that.
The noise emissions have higher noise. That's because CMB has been subtracted from the noise. Keep CMB back on.
Yeah, but I'm talking about this sort of ball in the middle.
Crescent shapes.
There's a scanning pattern, so it's much deeper in certain parts of the sky than other parts, and so I think you're seeing an artifact of that in this map. These are raw frequency maps.
Are they raw maps before the systematic error removed?
No, this is the final map that you subtract the most dominant component in the sky, which is CMB. After you remove that, what you see is noise, and that's what you're seeing there. Because Planck visits certain location in the sky many times, or many more than the other parts. When you visit some parts many more times, then you see less noise map of the other possibility. That's what it's saying here. But if you put CMB back in, you don't see it.
Sorry, one more question. At some dark matter people were talking about this dark WMAP Hayes. Did
Punk
see it?
No, actually, to be honest, I'd have to read up.
So they have this intermediate newspaper saying they see it.
So they've seen, yeah.
But they also see something like the WMAP Hayes, you
say? Yeah, but in the WMAP Nye paper, we say that WMAP Hayes is a model dependent signature. So first of all, it's family bubble, it's so gamma ray haze, and microwave haze are different things.
Right.
And gamma ray haze seems quite robust against how you do the data analysis.
Okay.
But for double nine data, for example, we failed to reproduce haze by ourselves. So we didn't think that the haze signature in the double was as robust as some little thing. But Planck has more frequencies, and they claim to see it. So
They claim to see it, yeah. How do you reconcile this with the WMAP9?
So we just have much fewer frequency coverage. And within that frequency coverage, Hayes signatures degenerate with many other components. But maybe with Planck's coverage, you can do a better job. But we haven't really reconciled the two components yet.
Roughly WMAP Planck showing difference in angular resolution as well, best seen at the bottom here. Don't know how fair this is. WMAP doesn't look as good in this picture as I've seen it look in other pictures.
People, SPT people, they all did this.
Enough. Okay, so why are you doing this? One reason is soundly to make an exquisite measurement of the temperature power spectrum. This is the usual wiggly line that you see here. Measuring at least 6 acoustic peaks, count them, maybe 7 if you're very generous to yourself, because you can see a line we're supposed to go. Incredibly small error bars everywhere here, so pretty fantastic, I think, and fairly definitive as far as temperature is concerned. This is just a slightly different plot showing residuals against a best fit model running through here. I think I'll skip that so I don't talk forever. You might find it useful to look at this picture, which compares the 4 current best CMB data sets, starting with WMAP9, Ikiro's data set, WMAP here in green, peters out around L of 1,000 or so. The error bars start to get large because the beam of WMAP is wider than Planck's. On small angular scales, we have the Atacama Cosmology Telescope and the South Pole Telescope data. You see them lurking in here, yellow and blue. They stop somewhere around here for the blue and here for the yellow and don't get to large angular scales because they're only looking at a small area of the sky and you need full sky coverage to reach this area.
So do they see the power ray symmetry?
No. They only look in one direction.
They only
no such luck. And the same direction more or less for each of them as well because they're both quite far in the south. So Planck basically interpolates between them rather nicely and is the single experiment that covers all the angular scales. Yeah. So I just did a few slides on the results. So I haven't changed this talk since I did it on the day of the release, and I was picking out a few things as I went along, so hopefully these are still relevant. For most of us as cosmologists, the thing you go and look at is the cosmological parameters table to find out what you think the values of the parameters are. Planck data is well fit by a 6-parameter model. It was also used for WMAP, where you vary the baryon density, the cold dark matter density. This is basically a version of the Hubble parameter. Optical depth, which measures how much reionization there is to last scattering, and then the properties of the primordial perturbation. So this is the bit that's interesting for inflation. The amplitude, measured extremely accurately, and the spectral index, or slope, of perturbations, measured to a fairly good degree of accuracy. And these are different versions. The one over here cheats and uses WMAP polarization data to make up for the fact that Planck polarization data wasn't available. So these numbers are really a Planck WMAP hybrid, if you like, whereas the other ones are Planck alone. So those are the numbers. I suppose all you're supposed to notice is the error bars are often tiny. For example, the baryon density here is measured to something like 1% accuracy. 1%? Yeah, 1% accuracy, more or less, which is a shame because no one here can predict it to better than about 10 orders of magnitude, I believe. So that accuracy is rather spoilt on you. the fundamental... These are the fundamental parameters that are fit to the data, but they often hide the things you're actually interested in, which tend to be the parameters themselves. So I picked out some of the so-called derived parameters that you can just get from these. The Hubble constant, if you're an astrophysicist, this is somewhat surprising that the best fit number is 67, because we'd all come to believe that it was probably a little bit more than 70 on the basis of WMAP and other observations. But the trend through WMAP 9, I think, was bringing it down already, and SPT as well. The trend has actually been to bring it down now significantly below 70. Bit of a surprising drift there. Going along with that, basically it's part and parcel of the same shift along a degeneracy curve. What this means is the density of dark matter has come up quite a bit from the WMAP type estimates and is now sitting above 30%. This is matter, so this is the combination of cold dark matter and baryons. And that means that the cosmological constant in this model has now fallen below 70% for the best fit value. So although this is very much the same stuff as WMAP, and it's just slightly smaller error bars for some of the parameters, there's also these shifts, which are maybe a little bit bigger than you'd have predicted.
So this is the stuff that bothers us, because I know where it came from. This really came from the fact that the Planck finds 2.5% less power in the first peak, and that's all.
That's right.
And that measurement is cosmic variance limited. So that means the Planck shifts must be the same things. Mm-hmm. And 2.5% shift is way bigger than what the difference should be. This is something that really is a subject of inconsistency of the data paper. So I run the numbers. So essentially, when you lower the first peak height by 2.5%, that is absorbed by raising omega matter h squared by 5%. And that's exactly what Planck finds. But peak position hasn't changed. And peak position fixes omega matter h cubed. And since you raise omega matter h squared by 5%, h naught must go down by 5%. That's exactly what you find. Mm-hmm. So all of this shift was coming from the difference that should be
one thing, that's there. Right.
And this, at the moment, we don't really know which one got it right.
Yeah.
And that's something
that's right.
We're trying to figure out.
Yeah. So I think there are lots of lessons in this, because these are statistical limits which are quoted by running some kind of statistical analysis mechanism. But before you get to that stage, there's an enormous amount of work in reducing the time-ordered data and particularly calibrating beam sizes and shapes. And there's many, many ways you can get that wrong. And so there is, I think, some inconsistency between Planck and WMAP at the endpoint. And I don't think there's any reason to presume that one is better than the other. But if there was, then WMAP obviously have 9 years of doing this. And Planck has 1 year of doing it, so on balance, WMAP would be more likely to be accurate, I would feel.
Well, I'm not sure.
I'm not allowed to say that. Oh, no, what have I done?
Yeah, we were looking
sacked from the collaboration.
But despite that, I think we should all be pleased to see that this NS parameter is now less than one by more than five sigma by single experiment. I guess plus WMAP for
it. Yes, it's not quite single experiment just yet.
But I think that's really an exciting result.
Plus also how stable it is when you add tensors and running, and so it doesn't grow.
So this is just the pie chart summary of it. This is basically WMAP, and this is Planck. So the pie's got slightly bigger up in this corner here. So then we've been talking a lot about the anomalies. So just to summarize what these anomalies are for people who may have been trying to, didn't know I could do that even. Just a whole new feature. To summarize what these are, there are various anomalies which were essentially all identified in WMAP data, which none of which on their own are very significant, but accumulated together are enough to unnerve people a little bit, because they suggest on the very largest scales we might not know how the cosmological model is working. So it's long been established that the quadrupole is much lower than it ought to be. It's almost not there at all. Unfortunately, the error bar on the quadrupole is of order. Predicted error bar is almost of order of the quadrupole, so it's not very surprising it's small. There's alignment of quadrupole and octopole, which is a little bit surprising. They seem to have a common preferred axis. There's the hemispherical asymmetry that people have been talking about. You can characterize this in different hemispheres. You can try to optimize a division that exaggerates the separation between the two halves of the sky as much as possible. So people have talked about north-south asymmetry in galactic coordinates, but that's probably not really necessary.
Yeah, I thought one of the new things that Planck said was that it wasn't just the quadrupole and octupole, but like the first 60 multiple numbers.
Yeah, I was going to come towards that. Yeah, Anatoly.
So this is a problematic question. What's the difference between dipole and hemispherical asymmetry?
It's the same thing.
It's not just why it goes up to high L, right? It's an asymmetry in power.
Yeah, it's a modulation of the power spectrum.
It means that even in odds, when you go into high L's, you have even an odd results for even an odd L jump.
So let's say you have a temperature anisotropy. Mm-hmm. You multiply that by some function. That function has a dipolar modulation.
Yeah.
Dipolar dependence. So that's hemispherical symmetry. You multiply the temperature field by quadrupole, something that's quadrupole, you generate quadrupolar symmetry. So in that sense, whatever that multiplies, the temperature anisotropy has a dipole dependence, that's in the hemisphere.
But it's different from the observed CMB dipole, which is in a different direction and of a completely different magnitude.
As well. In this plot you showed us, like the previous slide, the hemispherical symmetry goes into higher L's as well.
Yeah.
It's not in the plot.
Not in my Ava show.
All means that you have a sky, you divide them into two, and you measure power spectrum, which has values from L of 2 to any multiples. So you measure the power spectrum from southern sky and northern sky. Then you try to compare these two up to certain multiple in both hemispheres. And it seems that these asymmetry exist up to higher levels.
So there's a domain wall and a variance of
data. So I suspect this will be one of the main topics of discussion for the rest of
today. That's true. Take it at face value, it's a domain wall and a variance of data.
Right. But to answer Emma's question that you raised before, so I looked up the directions of the hemispherical symmetry. And directions vary with the multiple ranges. Sometimes it's close to actual dipole direction, universal motion. Sometimes it's closer to ecliptic direction, which is about 90 degrees apart, or on the galactic plane. So it really varies a lot depending on the
direction. It's not very accurately measured, so there's always going to be something on the sky which is not too far away from.
You're saying for every L up to 1,000, there is some asymmetry, but it's not in the same direction?
Because they are readjusting readjusting
in bands, I think. Okay.
So when they show the plot, it's readjusted.
Well, I'm not sure what's going on in the plot, but when I looked at the direction plot, then they are.
The original discovery was simply galactic north and galactic south were compared, and some difference was found. So there is an overall difference, which is direction dependent. And then people started moving the axis around, and you could, of course, always find an axis direction that maximizes the effect. So then, now you're saying people will split the data and find different directions within that. But
I think does it mean that there's some preferred direction? This hemispherical asymmetry can be taken as a preferred direction.
Yeah.
Right. And this direction is aligned with the perpendicular to the plane of our galaxy?
I don't think it's aligned. Well,
sometimes it's aligned with, so depending on the multiple, sometimes it's aligned with ecliptic plane, sometimes it's aligned with galactic plane, sometimes it's aligned with something else.
So what is the potential connection with the systematic error?
Well, and if it is aligned to either the ecliptic or galactic plane, it's almost certainly a systematic error because there's no reason why it should be. But there's the ecliptic plane, the galactic plane, there's a dipole direction, and it's not measured very accurately, so I'm not sure we can say anything. You know, all of these are very borderline, whether they really exist or not. Let me push on, because I think this is going to be a main topic of discussion, so you don't need to follow discussion of it now. Axis of evil was another thing, which was basically extension of quadrupole, octupole, up to about L of 5 or 6 by Landon McGagel. So the new thing from Planck that you were noting was that they have found low-angle discrepancies that go up at least to multiple of order 40. And this is a plot which is supposed to highlight it to you. You have to really squint at this. But a good place to look is just here, starting with this data point. So these are now individual multiple data points, so it's higher resolution plot. Notice all of these points are below the line. I think there's about 8 in a row. So this is the statistical equivalent of tossing a coin 8 times and getting heads every time. It's not enormously unlikely, but it's also a little bit uncomfortable.
I don't know.
Yeah. You have to decide, because how many times have these 8 coins been tossed is hard to know. I think it would be fair. These are the predictions of the standard cosmological model for a range of different values of the spectral index. You see that the mean value is predicted with almost no variation around here. If you squint carefully, you will no doubt notice that this is actually quite well fit by an oscillatory function of some sort. And you might be aware that oscillatory functions can be generated from various physical models, such as non-Bunch-Davies vacuum for the initial state before the perturbations are generated, or by various oscillating potential phenomena and so on.
But so, if you did that, then line goes through the points, right?
And so the line mustn't go through the points. So the trouble with all of these things is you can potentially try to improve the fit to the data by introducing a more complicated model, but because you've introduced a more complicated model, you should have been fitting the data better. And it's very hard to improve the fit to the data by enough to justify the complexity of any model you're introducing. And so this stuff is going to be quite hard to deal with.
If you add a sinusoidal modulation, which has an amplitude and a phase, what's the status of that?
I don't know.
What I read in the papers is it's not quite finished.
Yeah, I'm not involved in any of that particular work. I personally wouldn't believe it, but that's just me.
Excuse me, do cosmologists talk about look elsewhere effect?
Mm-hmm. They don't call it look elsewhere effect, but essentially, yes, mm-hmm. I think. Cosmologists operate much more in a Bayesian framework rather than the particle physicist frequentist one, where you have to be more careful about exactly what that is. But that's all around. Your point here is right, and the reason why we don't believe a lot of these things, even though they're nominally 3 or 4 or more sigma, is because we know that there were many other things that could have appeared in the data but didn't, which were no more odd than the things which have appeared, and that's essentially a version of the look elsewhere effect.
But I'm saying, essentially that effect can be quantified.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then you can talk about, in
this
context, how significant
it's 2 sigma.
So you
think it can be accurately quantified?
Yeah, I saw that number in the paper.
I charmed by your answer. I'm highly skeptical that you can look at something in the data and then a posteriori reconstruct how likely it was.
So they, for example, restrict the range in the L space, and then we fit the data to a different amplitude in particular L range. They found the amplitude was low. They vary then the multiple ranges and show various results. That's the elsewhere effect, right? And after Monte Carlo running the things, they found that the amplitude is low by about 2 sigma.
Yeah. But that doesn't fully quantify the fact that you picked out a particular feature of the data rather than any of the many features that weren't in the data.
So fair enough. So one thing that they did was to look that effect only up to, say, multiple 50.
Yeah.
If they had done it for a multiple, say, 2,000, I think it's effectively completely wrong.
Anyway, there'll be lots more discussion of this, I'm sure, so I'm going to push on and just show you a few more of the results so that I can end. This is, I think, a very nice result that's worth having a good look at, which is the effect of lensing from large-scale structure on the CMB. So CMB photons, when they come towards us, they don't travel on straight lines. They instead travel on slightly distorted lines due to gravitational lensing by all the intervening structures. And with a bit of clever messing around, you're able to figure out what the magnitude of that effect is and create a plot of the gravitational potential of the lensing field as shown here. So this is no longer the CMB anisotropies, but it's a plot of the gravitational potential, particularly the lensing potential, which is a difference of two, the relativistic potential, back along the line of sight. The gray is masked out region where the data is not good enough to do it. These are the Magellanic Clouds here, for example. They're various point sources. But what you see is a map of the large-scale potential distribution in the universe, which you could fairly say is basically a map of the position of all of the matter in the universe as measured by Planck, which is pretty nifty. This thing itself comes with a power spectrum. So this is the power spectrum here, constructed from different frequency channels. The colors show you the observational measurements with uncertainties, going from the largest angular scales here, again the quadrupole, up to the high resolution end. And the very nice thing about this is that this is a model prediction here, which is clearly in very good agreement with what you expect. And so the gravitational lensing power spectrum itself has constraining power. And in the table I showed you earlier, the middle column combined the CMB temperature with the lensing potential constraints to slightly tighten the error bars.
Is this a CDM model? What is the model?
This is the same lambda CDM standard model fit in this case. I think that's a very nice result indeed. So we like that there. And it's 25 sigma, so you can't really argue with that one.
Sorry, if you go back. Am I exaggerating to say that, you know, there seems to be some oscillatory behavior in the tail?
I do believe you are.
But I mean, and across three different frequencies.
My eyes are too.
Anyway.
I'm looking like I don't know. I personally don't see it. I think having boxes rather than points with error bars may exaggerate it, but.
So we're going to have Karanya here.
Yeah.
We're doing the oscillation analysis. Okay.
Non-Gaussianity. This is primordial non-Gaussianity. This was one of the hopes for Planck, which was not realized, and would be the discovery of primordial non-Gaussianity, indicating non-linear phenomena occurring during the generation of perturbations, such as inflation. And basically, no detection. These are the numbers for three of the favorite shapes of non-Gaussianity. Aficionados will know you can predict slightly different shapes. These are the three-point functions of the correlators. So all of these numbers, as you will see, are consistent with zero. In fact, very consistent with zero. They're all even within one sigma of zero. So there's no detection of this. There is a borderline detection of a predicted bispectrum, that's three-point function effect, which comes from a correlation between a thing called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect and lensing, which predicts a signal that should be present at some level. And this is borderline detected at 2 to 3 sigma. If you look at a picture, which I might have actually, you're supposed to be able to see it. So this is the Planck bispectrum. Basically, if I understand correctly, though Akira is the expert, these are basically pictures of noise. The ISW lensing bispectrum signal is predicted to be an oscillatory feature that runs along the axis of this so-called polypid. The lensing bispectrum is a function of three angles or three lengths, so it lives inside this funny tetrahedral shape here. So I think the predicted signal is the oscillatory feature that runs along here, which you can allegedly see, though I would never have noticed it if I hadn't been told that was where I was to look. All of this stuff in the middle is noise, and what you were hoping to see in here was something that looked a bit like the spectrum. As you ran along a particular axis, you should have seen peaks and troughs in the bispectrum signal, and the different shapes here predict different kinds of patterns inside this, and you're doing a kind of a matching analysis. But these are pictures of noise. Though there's clearly a pile of stuff, you know, and it might not be impossible that you could find
some. Part of the non-Gaussian band, maybe on the face of this spectrum, there was also an oscillating feature. If you look at the
panic before thing,
Do you mean that part?
Want to point
meant
at
to
it?
Meant to be visible on here, that like when you look at the face, that there's a change from
this face.
This, I think
they said yeah. That Lagrangian effect killed those things.
Yeah, maybe if there was a three-dimensional spinning version where you could actually really see the structure, maybe. But.
The left one and the right one. This is the same data analyzing different waves. So.
Different
coordinate systems.
That's right. It's a different splitting of the bispectrum into modes. So you basically estimate it by and separating the function into a set of modes and reconstructing the amplitude of these modes. So they're independent, yeah. It's like doing independent basis, so like doing wavelets versus Fourier analysis for a normal power spectrum, something like that. So the Planck policy is you have to do everything at least twice for any result, which is then really annoying if you were one of the two and it's not the one that's chosen to go in the actual paper, but they appear in these comparisons. So I guess these are supposed to show something that's similar, but you can see there's significant noise. Well, anyway, didn't happen. Inflation.
The error on FNL equilateral has somehow shrunk much less than the other two. So it's actually, if you compare it to W map, that one has only shrunk by a factor of 2, where the other one shrunk by a factor of 3. Just closer to what you expect, but
it allows a sound speed of 0.1, but it's still,
it
didn't.
I was just a bit surprised that
they didn't all decrease together.
And somehow, the improvement on the error in the collateral configuration was somehow less than real.
No, as you go to smaller angles, are there fewer extra equilaterals than there are of other shapes?
They seem somewhat scary, frankly, with the maps.
I think the equilaterals.
Does have some squeeze configurations, so that scales similarly with the total. It's very different, so maybe that's the reason. But I don't actually know that quantitative data.
Yeah. Inflation, I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about. This is the picture they've already showed. No detection of tensors is the headline result, I think, which obviously would have been very nice if it had happened. But if anything, the opposite has happened, and the favored models seem to be below the axis in a very unphysical way. It's also worth commenting on, as was just mentioned, the non-Gaussianity limits. It's sad not to detect a non-Gaussianity, but we have learned something about inflation models from having the tighter constraints on non-Gaussianity, which are starting to, they eliminate very low sound speeds for the scalar field. I think 0.1 is about the number, as far as I remember. And they constrain some variants of models, such as the curvaton model. I'll zoom through this. The thing I mainly worked on was galaxy clusters seen through the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. We have the biggest all-sky catalog ever. Here it is, 1,000 and a bit candidates, almost all of which are real. There is one quite significant result from this. We can use galaxy clusters to constrain the power spectrum of the matter perturbations. It's just like using large-scale structure of any other kind. But there's a very significant discrepancy between the result that we get from clusters, which is the blue, versus the primary CMB Planck result, which is the one I showed you earlier with the numbers, which is up here. WMAP, incidentally, sits somewhere in the middle, so basically the primary CMB from Planck has bigger omega matter and also slightly bigger sigma 8 than WMAP had. WMAP would probably be consistent with either one of these. So this inconsistency is there in the data, and there's several reasons why this might, of how to try and understand that discrepancy. One is that somebody's done it wrong, which is perfectly possible, and it might be us in the cluster group, or it might be the primary CMB people. One is that we don't understand galaxy clusters as well as we thought we did, and for people who do that kind of stuff, there are a lot of uncertainties in there, but it would be really be stretching our understanding of galaxy clusters to modify their properties in a way that would move this curve up to be consistent with this. And the final possibility is that these are discrepant because we're missing some new physics that should be in the models. And the thing you have to know here is the galaxy clusters are actually probing the power spectrum on a rather short length scale as compared to the primary CMB. So you're not quite comparing like with like, you're comparing things on different length scales. So anything that modifies the shape of the primordial power spectrum on short scales can help bring these two into agreement, and what it has to do is reduce the power on short scales for the clusters. So there are various well-motivated ways you could try to do this. You could modify the shape of the primordial power spectrum through having running of the spectral index. Or the one we investigated in the Planck paper was you could have masses for the neutrinos. And it's long been known that one of the best ways of probing the absolute masses of neutrinos is their effect on large-scale structures such as galaxy clusters. And if we include masses of neutrinos, then I think the blue line is the one we'd like to draw your attention to here. This is the total mass of the three families of neutrinos in electron volts, so about 0.2 here, would be enough to slide this data, well, these two data sets onto each other there. You can see it's not very convincing. A particle physicist would just chortle and say, what on earth is that? That's nowhere near zero. But it's nevertheless an indication that neutrino masses could do something for us. However, if you believe the neutrino oscillation experiments and the minimal hierarchy for fixing it, I think the number is 0.008, 0.05 here, which would be down here, is where we're expected to be, and here is not where we're expected to be.
What's the other two curves?
These are different versions of the analysis, and I'd have to read them myself. So the Planck CMB data alone has no discrepancy, so it's this black line here, and they just set an upper limit, which is somewhere over here. The other lines are combining our cluster data with the Planck CMB data under different assumptions, and then combining some other data sets as well. So these are just different options. We happen to like the blue because it's got the most data, and those data all seem consistent with each other. So I'm not really claiming anything very strong, but it's potentially interesting. There may be some new physics hiding in these results somewhere. I don't think I'll tell you about that, even though it's quite interesting. I definitely won't tell you about that. There are a few miscellaneous results that are worth mentioning, which are scattered around these 28 papers. There was a search for cosmic strings, which there is no detection, and indeed other topological defects are also searched for. Definitely don't want to know about maps of galactic carbon monoxide emission, though this is quite interesting. If you are interested in the quantum state of the universe, then you might be interested to know that, as far as we're aware, the geometry and topology of the universe are flat and trivial. Obviously, we have no idea whether that's true out to some enormously large distance, but there is no evidence of non-trivial topology or of non-flat geometry within our own observable universe. That I won't bother talking about either. This I just talk about out of interest. I was surprised anyone was willing to do the calculation. The CMB dipole is the biggest feature in the CMB. Its size is about 10 to the minus 3. If you make a CMB map, the first thing you have to do is get rid of the CMB dipole before you can do anything else. But it turns out that there are special relativistic effects related to the dipole, which is to do with our motion relative to the CMB rest frame, which correspond to an aberration, a relativistic aberration, and also modulation of the power. These are at V over C squared order, so they're 10 to the minus 6. And are very hard to detect, but there is a paper led by Douglas Scott where they do manage to make some reasonably convincing detection just using aberration and modulation, that you can measure our own velocity relative to the CMB that way. So the aberration is the focusing of light rays in front of you and the spreading out behind. The magnitude of the effect is such that if you consider the peak, say a peak at L of 1,000, if you looked backwards, then the light rays are spread out by aberration. It moves by 0.1%, so therefore the peak you thought was going to be at 1,000 is instead at 999. In the forward direction, it's instead at 1,001 from this effect. So it's a minuscule variation, but if you analyze over the entire sky, you can actually see it. And so I thought that was quite an interesting thing. And further proof, I suppose, that we really do move relative to the CMB rest frame. So that's me, I think. But to comment at the end, the full mission release is in about a year's time. So twice as much data will include polarization and will hopefully be analyzed more rigorously as well. So there's good reason to think that there'll be quite significant advances in all of these areas in the full release data next year.
So the first year temperature power spectrum, it's very conservative, right? So they actually use only 30% of the sky. Would that change for the next release? Because, for example, the error on NS, I think that was not the smaller.
It should have been much smaller.
Essentially, you didn't use much of the sky.
Much of the sky, yeah. So hopefully that all comes under this part here.
Yeah.
There's no doubt it was all very, very rushed in the end. I'm sure it's the experience of everyone who's worked on these kinds of projects.
That's right.
Okay. I think I'm done. Hope that was useful for you.